Hello, folks, and welcome to the Antifada. This is a Sean and Andy episode. We have a very special guest with us today. We have Reed Kane, who goes by on Twitter, old-fashioned Marxist or at Socialist Legacy, and a real barnstormer when it comes to using that blue check mark to make really expansive tweets talking about socialist concepts, Marxism, and everything like that. So welcome to the show, Reed, and thanks for all of your propaganda on Twitter these days.
Thank you for having me. I'm still kind of amazed that anyone cares to read the insane rambling I put out there, but happy to do it for sure.
I think you're doing some good work. I first found you, I think, on Twitter, but you've also done some interviews and discussions with Sublation Media. Is that right?
Yeah. I've written a few articles for Sublation Magazine. I have actually quite a few drafts of articles that really need to be finished that I've been putting off for a while as well. And I've done some appearances on their YouTube channel and some other YouTube channels as well. I'm also a member of the Platypus Affiliated Society, although this is, you know, my own personal thing. This isn't me in my capacity as a member.
right. So this is all Reed Kane here. So tell us a bit about your project, your understanding of socialism, why you call yourself old-fashioned Marxist, and what the socialist legacy is that you're trying to uphold.
Sure. Well, I came to Marxism the way I think a lot of people do. You know, as a young person, I was sort of turned on to the writings of Karl Marx and sort of became increasingly fascinated by both his ideas and, you know, his writing, but also increasingly the history attached to it. But there was, you know, a great deal of dissonance between that kind of impression you get from reading Marx and the actual world we live in. It's not necessarily obvious dissonance at first, depending on kind of your perspective. You know, especially younger people can sort of warp the world into their own, you know, vision of what it is as opposed to what it really is. But
I was really good at that in the 90s, I tell you.
Right. you go through that phase, I think, but at a certain point you realize that this history is very, at quite a far remove from our own, which isn't to say that it's not really, importantly related to the history of the present, but it's not as if Marx is someone who's writing at the moment about what's happening at the moment. And something that always sort of was something that always I always was trying to make sense of as I was reading Marx was not only trying to understand the nature of his own sort of intellectual project, which was the way I was mostly approaching it for a while. You know, I ended up going to college and then grad school, primarily focused on understanding Marx within the context of philosophy for the most part, and to a lesser extent, economic theory and labor history, but primarily philosophy. But that's really not, obviously, that's not, it's really not an adequate understanding of Marx to look at him that way for rather obvious reasons. Marx was above all, as Engels put it, a revolutionary, and his project is fundamentally a political project. And it was a political project embedded in a set of circumstances, a set of historical conditions that he didn't bring about, that they, you know, they already existed. And he was engaging with those conditions and trying to have an impact on them, based on his own sort of assessment of the historical trajectory that the world was on at the time. The thing that is sort of, I certainly found very difficult to wrap my head around for a long time, wasn't so much like an abstruse and obscure, you know, kind of conceptual problem or theoretical problem. Although that's really the way I was approaching it for a long time.
You were first three chapters of Capital guy, huh?
Yes. You know, Capital was certainly part of that head scratcher for me, but yeah. I was really more in the, you know, the German ideology and the economic and philosophic manuscripts, like a lot of the unpublished material that right. of the so-called young Marx, you know, the immature Marx, or maybe the more profound Marx before he became this sort of, you know, not that this is my perspective, but some people will take this perspective that Marx sort of, you know, there's on the one hand, there's the people that see the mature scientific Marx as the true Marx. And then right. there's some that see like the young, like idealistic humanist Marx right. as the true Marx.
Right.
I was a little bit more enwrapped by that, although I did try to kind of engage him as his work as holistically as I could. But what was missing from the equation wasn't, it wasn't like a theoretical problem. It was really a lack of understanding of history, and specifically the history that connects our moment to Marx's moment. So not like Marx's context, as if that's something on its own, but really the sense in which we're part of a historical process that was unfolding in Marx's day and that is still unfolding, but that has been fundamentally redirected, or its course has been fundamentally impacted in some manner by Marxism itself. Right. And obviously the most kind of unavoidable manner in which that took place was the Soviet Union, so-called really existing socialism in its various forms, and the Cold War that dominated world history for, you know, what was it, 70 years or something. Yeah. So that was something that it took me a long time to really understand and appreciate, to kind of get out of that more philosophical register and realize that the history is the real substance. Mm. And you don't really get a sense of the theoretical project's real significance and its real merits until you see it as a reflection on an ongoing historical process and an engagement with an intervention within that process,
right.
As specifically in a political form. So my understanding of Marxism now that I've sort of, I think, come out the other side of that process of intellectual development, is really that the failure of socialism in the early 20th century, the failure of the original project of revolutionary social democracy, the Marxist leaders of the Second International, specifically for example, well, Lenin above all, of course. And today is actually Lenin's birthday.
Oh, happy birthday,
the day Lenin. the day we're recording this, as well as Rosa Luxemburg, for example, or a figure very close to my own heart, Eugene Debs from the Socialist Party of America. You know, I think that revolutionary project, it failed. And the left that emerged out of that failure over the course of the 20th century, beginning in the 20s and really kind of taking a new sort of consolidated shape in the 30s, and then obviously kind of iterating over the course of several generations up to the present, is really the product of the failure of that movement, but not simply its failure in the sense that it was unable to accomplish what it was seeking to accomplish, namely an international working class revolution that seized power in the heart of global capitalism. Not only did that fail, but more importantly and much more consequentially, the movement itself failed to learn from that experience in the way that what Marxism really was as a theory was an attempt to help the working class movement learn from its failures, its mistakes, its defeats, in order to develop through them and advance through them instead of being undermined by them. So that was what Marxism was. It was this theoretical organon, if you will, that was meant to help the working class understand the struggles it was going through in order to ruthlessly criticize the inadequate half measures that that it inevitably must pass through as the struggle develops, in order for that struggle to continue to develop on that basis. So that's really the significance of Marxism, but that's precisely what was really lost, or at least damaged and fragmented and sort of scattered into a thousand different pieces during the early, you know, the first few decades after the Russian Revolution. And since then, those fragments have only continued to deteriorate and disintegrate, either into nothing at all, and they've simply vanished, or they've sort of degraded even further to the point that they're hardly even recognizable as kind of rooted in that original tradition or having anything meaningful to do with Marx's theoretical intervention. So I really want to bring back that old-fashioned sense of Marxism that is really just completely outside the scope of most people's understanding of this history, even people that really invest a lot of their time and energy in thinking about this stuff.
And this perspective that you have and this critique and understanding of the history is the reason why I wanted to have you on, given the immense failures of not just the Second International, of course, but 20th century official Marxism, Marxism-Leninism, Marxism-Leninism-Maoism, to have a decisive break with capitalist production in the capitalist core. All sorts of people, and I include myself in this and Andy in this, and I think a lot of the listeners too, we all try to reach back into the 19th and 20th century and find some nugget, some pearls of wisdom, some practice and theory, some historical tendencies. You know, we just lost Lauren Goldner last week. So what a gentleman like Lauren Goldner does coming of age in the 1960s is try to resuscitate a dissident Marxism, council communist or left communist Marxism, a Bordigist Marxism. And then the new left, of course, too, tried its various variants of reviving this project. What is it about the Second International period, or more specifically, the Socialist Party USA in the late 19th and early 20th century, that holds a key for you to for us to understand where we went wrong and what we might do right again?
Well, none of it is really so much the positive example. Although I do think there are positive lessons to draw to in various ways, they would nonetheless need to be qualified by the changed circumstances in order to have any real significance in the present. It's really more the, if you will, the negative aspect, the critical aspect, the self-critical aspect, precisely in the form of the, you know, these parties were not uniform monolithic parties, as I'm sure you know, which is unfortunately what, you know, that, you know, in retrospect, that's seen as a shortcoming by a lot of people. You know, they weren't these sort of homogenous, you know, revolutionary parties, right, that supposedly that's what Lenin told us we needed to have, which is a total, you know, distortion of Lenin. It's really more, you know, that aspect of it was really important, not because having like a multi-tendency party is in and of itself a good thing, but because the party needs to be the site in which the most advanced section of the working class works through the conflicts in society in a sort of concentrated way. Because it's going to confront this, those same contradictions that face it from without, from within as well. And in order to sort of steel itself for that conflict with the broader forces at play in society, it needs to be able to work through them in itself, in its own activity, in the activity constitutive of the movement and the various organizations and activities involved in it. So, you know, the struggle between different tendencies is really important. It's not simply a matter of getting rid of the bad tendencies and only having the correct tendency. This idea of the correct tendency is just so poisonous, not because there is nothing that's correct, but because you need to work through those conflicts in the practice of organizing this movement and conducting the activity that it exists to engage in. And it's only in the course of that that the problems actually manifest themselves in concrete ways that can make sense to people that aren't kind of purely thinking about it from like an abstract theoretical perspective, which is the vast majority of the people involved. And frankly, the people that only look at it from the theoretical perspective have their own shortcomings, of course, their own liabilities. With respect to the Socialist Party of America, it has that as well, although it also has, unfortunately, maybe the least among the least developed Marxist leadership compared to the other major parties. Certainly, you know, nothing really compares to that of the Bolsheviks. But even, say, compared to the left wing of the Social Democratic Party of Germany, you know, the left wing in the United States was always very immature and sort of fragmented. Nonetheless, it did have a lot of merits. I think for me, the real significance of the Socialist Party of America has to do with its context, in the sense that it's engaged with the United States of America. The history and the peculiar character of the United States as a site for class struggle, which doesn't really, it's not really something that you can simply take the sort of slogans and the frameworks, the ways of thinking that were predominated on in Europe. You can't really translate those directly to the United States, because there is a very radically different situation in terms of the political, you know, the political constitution, but also the revolutionary history underlying it. Right. You know, the United States is the only country really that has a full-fledged, fully successful bourgeois revolution that never collapses into reaction, at least not in the way it does in Europe. Now, really it does by the end of the 20th century, but it nonetheless retains at least the form of the Democratic Republic, even if it has this sort of authoritarian, you know, monstrosity growing beneath the surface of the constitutional forms of governance until they kind of break out into the open in the 20th century. There is a lot about the American tradition that gets sort of taken up by the Socialist Party of America, and they really are able to, in their best elements, communicate Marxism in a way that is applicable from the standpoint of American workers. And when I say that, I don't just mean like native-born American workers, but anyone in America, you know, immigrants as well, because immigrants coming to the United States are coming because they want to be American workers, right? You know, to, you know, maybe not immediately, but generally speaking, that promise of freedom that existed ostensibly in the United States that did not exist in Europe was a big part of the appeal. It wasn't purely an economic, a lot of the time, at least, motivation. So
we had, as you said, a relatively weak left wing of the Socialist Party, which largely becomes then the CPUSA in the 1920s. Is that right? But in a time when the Socialist Party is already in decline.
Yeah, decline is maybe too gentle a word. It really was completely destroyed. You know, the party, I don't remember the exact numbers off the top of my head, but the party membership rolls going into the election of 1920. I wish I had the numbers ready to hand, but
you didn't know there'd be a pop quiz.
Yeah, I used to have this memorized, but let's just say for the sake of argument, it's 100,000 people. It would be a drastic understatement to say that the party was decimated, because to decimate means to remove 1/10 of something. Mm. 9/10 of the party were no longer members after 1920, between 1920 and I think 1924. Mm. It was reduced to about 10,000 people, again, assuming that number is correct. It's somewhere in that range. It was a massive loss, and it is not entirely accounted for by looking at the Communist Party. Part of it is drawn to the Communist Party, but a lot of it is just people are just they are demoralized, or they're simply thrown out of participation. You know, part of that, a major part of that, is incredibly fierce political repression and social
Red
repression.
Scare, yeah.
Yeah, the first Red Scare, which was, you know, part of that was the federal government. It wasn't yet the FBI, but it was undertaken by what would become the FBI. J. Edgar Hoover instrumental in it. But it was also, you know, I mean, you also have a lot of, civil society groups engaging in smashing up socialist party gatherings and offices and, you know, printing presses and as well as IWW and other trade union organizations, and pacifist groups more generally as well. The KKK comes back in this period, and a major part of its activity is smashing the Reds. So yeah, it's definitely a pretty brutal time, but you can't really account for it entirely in terms of this repression. The demoralization is a major part of it as well. And this gets to what I was saying a moment ago, which is that there wasn't really, I think, a firm core of clear-headed Marxist leadership that would have been able to lead through that process in a way that could have kind of maintained it. And the best you really had, I think, would have been Debs, but Debs was a very old man at that point. He dies in, I think, 1926, and he's still really, pretty vigorous.
Yeah, prison really knocked him back too, right?
Yeah, the prison totally sapped what was left of his health. He was still pretty vigorous toward up to the end, but he was one man, and he was more of like a Babel figure than like an August Babel than, say, a Lenin. You know, he was suited to an earlier phase of the struggle, but he couldn't lead it into the next phase. You know, there needed to be a new generation to take up the reins, and that generation was there, but it didn't become what it needed to become. You know, because some of it went into the Communist Party, but
the union movement is obviously knocked back in this Wilsonian, at the end of the First World War. Is the failure of the Socialist Party to survive the repression and the demoralization, is that up to the split nature of the Socialist movement in the United States, with like the IWW and AFL on the one hand and the Socialist Party on the other, unable to create some sort of merger between them, or is it changing composition of capital, or is it geopolitics? What do you account for that?
Well, the point you're making about the trade unions, the orientation towards the labor movement, towards the unions, was a big part of it for sure. So you have, there's a big internal controversy in the party around 1911, 1912, having to do with this very question. And really the formation of the IWW is sort of it's an interesting moment, and there's the IWW is very important for a lot of reasons, but part of what it represents is a impatience with the party's mainstream orientation towards the AFL, which was, it's now characterized in terms of like the boring from within strategy, trying to essentially get socialists in the AFL unions to gain more and more influence and standing and ultimately office, and use that to take over the AFL ultimately was the goal. And there was a bid for that, whose highest point was, I think it was in 1912, when the socialist candidate to unseat Gompers, failed. But really, there were, the mainstream of the party's leadership did have maybe more of a sort of conciliatory attitude towards the AFL leadership, precisely because they leaned on the AFL unions as a significant base of support for various local organizations, like Milwaukee being the most notorious in that regard, the most conservative, the kind of bastion of conservatism in the party. But it wasn't just Milwaukee.
That was Victor Berger and the sewer socialists, right, in Milwaukee?
Right, Victor Berger, who, as many faults as Victor Berger had, and he certainly had his faults, he's nonetheless a far more radical figure in a lot of respects than the pseudo-radicalism that of people that might denounce him if they knew anything about him, which I'm sure a lot of them don't know anything about him at all. So he, for example, I just happened upon this article in, I can't remember which it was, in what, some old Socialist Party newspaper, where someone quoted Victor Berger, who was known as a conservative figure in the party, to show how radical he was by comparison to somebody else, because Berger was basically saying the party, the members of the party, the working class, need to be armed, and we need to be prepared if the state brings repressive force against us to have an armed uprising. So it's like, this guy's a conservative, but he's talking about armed revolution.
And so this was, you know, millions of people passed through between the IWW and the Socialist Party in the period between like the 1880s and let's say the 19 teens. The fact that nothing much is left of that, and the fact that it feels like the closest, say, American communists have to some legacy might be the CPUSA and Browderism or something like that. How is it that it, like the new left generation, with the exception maybe of with public figures like Bernie Sanders, who somehow is a huge Eugene Debs fan despite his politics, how was it that the new left kind of missed this? How come? Why is it that the new left doesn't seek to recreate this sort of diverse mass party body that existed in the past?
Well, there is an attempt in that direction. Unfortunately, it's not. I mean, really, the problem is that the new left generation was left high and dry by the older generation that should have educated them. They didn't have a good education. There were really very few from the older generation that were pointing in anything resembling what I at least would consider to be the right direction, or at least pointing back to the old Marxism of the, you know, the pre-World War I period as something to be taken up in earnest, as opposed to looking back to the 30s with nostalgia, and or really kind of an ambivalent nostalgia.
Yeah, you know, because there's this sort of new left is just as critical of big labor, you know, as big capital, and for good reason, right? But it seems to me that by the 1960s, the 30s had seemed like a sort of victory in a sense, and right. Something to be built upon, or something to be rejected completely due to the right. Business nature aspect of the Popular Front, basically.
There's a sort of a zigzag back and forth, just as there is within the Communist Party in the 20s and 30s. There's a zigzag in reaction to that legacy by the new left between, on the one hand, a sort of ultra-left rejection of really Stalinism, as well as reformist social democracy. But really, I think those are two sides of the same coin. You know, there's a rejection of it on the one hand in a kind of an ultra-left way that takes Maoism as its inspiration, you know. So, but in that sense, it's really hearkening back to like third period Stalinism.
Yeah, it's a weird. It's weird. Yeah. You said that the, you know, talking about the sort of duality of the social democracy and Stalinism, right? The Popular Front, of course, arises under the conditions of Stalinism. And the rejection of it into anti-revisionism is doubling down on that same Stalinism.
Exactly. And it's, and really, I mean, the thing about Stalinism to understand, I think, is what it really is a sort of, it's really an incoherent politics, because the substance of its politics is secondary to the instrumental purposes of the regime. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it doesn't need to be coherent. It just needs to serve the functions of the bureaucracy.
Right. It's an opportunistic pragmatism.
Right. Yes. And so it kind of goes back and forth between this ultra right wing and this ultra left wing. I mean, with relative to, you know, revolutionary socialism, of course, not ultra right in a general sense. Although I don't know, maybe. You know, so there is this sort of there's just not an understanding of how to make sense of this history. There's very few sources of that sort of an understanding in the new left generation, and they just never really are able to figure it out. And what they ultimately end up doing is doubling down on the confusion of the previous generation,
right,
and sort of making an even more confused product as a result. And that's now happened again in the contemporary generation. You know, I wanted to actually go back to the previous question though, in relation to this, because there is, so I was saying about the IWW, you know, the interesting thing about it is, you know, so Debs had been, you know, a pioneer of industrial unionism in the United States in the 1890s
with the
American Railway Union.
Yeah.
And he, you know, became, you know, a very stalwart champion of industrial unionism after that point. But he also had, certainly after the defeat of the Pullman strike, and in the first few, I think up until at least, you know, the 1911, 1912 period, he had a real ambivalence about trade unionism. And that was part of what motivated his attraction to the IWW when it was coming together, which was sort of, on the one hand, it took inspiration from European syndicalism to some extent and anarchism, but it also turned back to like Daniel De Leon, who had this sort of heterodox form of Marxism. He was the leader of the Socialist Labor Party, who had a sort of union, an almost quasi-syndicalist interpretation of Marxism, which one of the major elements of it was advocacy of dual unionism, specifically like revolutionary dual unions. So competing with the AFL unions from without. And Debs was, on the one hand, he was like kind of fed up with the unions. And so when he did convert to socialism, part of the motivation was not that he was giving up on the union movement, certainly not, but he basically was like, the unions can't do anything without political action, without a political arm. And ultimately, the unions won't be able to kind of fulfill their own purpose on their own. It's only in conjunction with the political leadership, with the political revolution, you know, because Debs faced the full force of the state coming down against him,
right,
you know, leading a union. So he had good reason to think that. And on top of that, he's very contemptuous of the conservatism of AFL unions and also like the railroad brotherhoods and so on. So, you know, he definitely wants to sort of smash up this old unionism. And so that sort of attracts him to that project. But, you know, as great as the IWW was in its heyday, and there's a lot to be said for it, there is this sort of false opposition between working outside the AFL unions in a revolutionary way or working within them in a kind of essentially counter-revolutionary way, where they're essentially subordinating the socialist movement to the dictates of the trade union bureaucracy, the labor leaders in the AFL. But that wasn't really the full extent of the engagement with the AFL. It wasn't simply about it wasn't about the Socialist Party should simply be the voice of what the AFL leadership already wants. That was not the idea. The idea was to bring a struggle into the AFL unions. And that was defeated both through resistance by the AFL union leadership and by the conservative elements in the Socialist Party leadership. And basically the IWW and Bill Haywood in particular was used as a sort of a scapegoat to warn against a more radical orientation towards the trade unions, because it took the form of dual unionism, sabotage, basically inviting state repression, inviting opposition from rank and file workers in the AFL unions, and so on. Mm-hmm. So that was an unfortunate, there were a lot of things that happened around 1912 that really spelled the doom earlier, even though that was also the height of the party's reach and influence. So there is a moment around in the 1920, you know, around 1919 to 1924, where a wobbly, William Foster, William Z. Foster, who would end up becoming one of the main leaders in the Communist Party, basically had this recognition and said, you know, we need something like the IWW that's not going to, in a sort of sectarian way, isolate itself from the need to engage within the existing unions. But that's going to do the same sort of thing inside those unions that it does for the workers that those unions have no interest in organizing. And he ends up creating an organization called the Trade Union Educational League,
right,
that is a cornerstone of the early Communist Party, but also a cornerstone of a perspective united front between the remnant of the Socialist Party and the fledgling Communist Party that Debs was very interested in. And he met with Foster to discuss the prospects of that. But unfortunately, very, very quickly within, I think by 1924, their orders came from Moscow, from the Comintern, that the Trade Union Educational League's orientation needed to be replaced by a different orientation, which was precisely a dual union orientation. And it was ironically renamed the Trade Union Unity League, even though it actually ended up pursuing a sort of anti-unity policy of forming revolutionary red unions outside the existing union. So, and then Foster basically over time is basically shaped into a stooge of the Comintern, you know, sadly. So there is this missed opportunity there. And that's what I look to. I look to that missed opportunity and to the broader history that's like the sort of the end point of, as you know, there's a missed opportunity that the new left generation didn't take very seriously. Or really know much about it all, unfortunately.
Well, that is a great and full history that you give us. And it's important, I think, to note for all of us to know this sort of hinge point, right, so that we can look into this. What, in your estimation, looking back, like what would have been a socialist movement adequate to American capitalism of the early 20th century? Would
that's
it
a good question.
The Socialist Party, would it have a nationalization plank? Would it have conceded to the syndicalist wing more? What's your sense?
I think the platforms of the party, certainly at least up till 1920, were perfectly adequate. In particular, the 1904 platform is in a personal favorite of mine. Pardon me. In particular, so, you know, there is this idea floating around in the American socialist movement from the 1870s onward, which during that time, the socialist movement was, on the one hand, it was like the last holdouts of the utopian communalist tradition, which gets a little bit of a revival in that period, but is sort of on the way out. There's a deeper history going back to the early Republic of socialist communal, you know, Fourierist and Owenist communities and so on, and as well as Christian communities and all sorts of things. And then there's also this like smattering of German 48ers and later German immigrants who bring Marxism and LaSallianism with them, but aren't able to really penetrate into the broader, the broader American working class, in part because it's still sort of in an embryonic phase during that period. It's really starting to take shape in the 1870s in the wake of the Civil War and the industrialization that follows, or that actually coincides with and then follows the Civil War. The American working class is really, really defined in the 1880s and 1890s. Yeah. And during that period, these German emigre socialist radicals are having a difficult time getting a grip on the domestic situation. They're writing to Marx and Engels for advice. And, you know, Engels in particular is basically saying, look, you're hiving yourselves off in your little immigrant communities. You're only speaking German. You're only printing German language newspapers. And you're trying to basically bring this European, you know, you're basically trying to take these ideas from this European context and simply transplant them as if they will speak to the people there directly, when of course they won't. You know, our ideas, Engels, this is Engels speaking, you know, our ideas are not like a formula to be rehearsed. It's a theory of social evolution, and that evolution can take different forms. So it's not about simply applying a formula to any given circumstance. It's about understanding the unique characteristics of how things are developing in a given context and understanding how that will feed into this broader historical process that it's bound up with. So it's about navigating the unique circumstances, and using them to your advantage rather than about simply trying to force something on people that doesn't speak to them. And in that regard, so basically the idea was they had to make Marxism speak English, American English in particular, which was a struggle. And it really doesn't happen until the turn of the 20th century with the really, so I can't remember who it was, but one of the, I think it might've been Herman Titus, who was a left-wing leader in the Socialist Party, who said the 1904 platform was the point at which the socialists in America finally figured out how to make Marxism speak you know, American English, if you will.
Using your
and it's a brilliant platform. I mean, I think anyone and the other platforms from this period are great as well. And you could also look to like the speeches and the newspapers and there's this immense archive of pamphlets and books that were like probably thousands that just nobody's read any of these things in 100 years, you know. There's just an incredible archive of materials of people trying to figure this out and actually having a great deal of success. Mm. So in that, and I think a lot of that really still speaks to American sensibilities, honestly. It may be a little bit more of a stretch than it was then, but it still rings true, a lot of it. You know, this idea, for example, that the socialists are the only true defenders of individual liberty and self-government, the ideals on which the United States was founded. Mm. The only people that are defending the ability of working people to live independently through their own labor, because it's not possible to do so in the old way anymore because of capitalism.
Right.
So, you know, there is this, and as well as, for example, invocations of like the Declaration of Independence, you know, the working class needs their own, you know, Declaration of Independence, you know, analogizing the American Revolution, you know, the war against the British to like a strike. So, you know, there's a lot of this sort of language of trying to take up American revolutionary traditions and adapt them to the changed circumstances of capitalism and use them to help make sense of the problem, this new problem that emerges with the coming of the Industrial Revolution in full force to the United States. So I think that still has a lot of value today to explore those ways of adapting Marxism to an American idiom. It was really profoundly successful in a lot of ways. And so could it have gone further? I think it probably could have, but ultimately I don't think the failure of the Socialist Party in America can be chalked up to America. I think it's ultimately the failure of the international movement that leads to its demise. And so it's not as if like, if Debs only had like a cadre of dedicated revolutionaries, they could have pulled it out. Maybe that is the case. I don't know, but I think it's sort of like idle speculation, you know. Right. Ultimately, the revolution at that time would have had to be won in Germany, France, and England, and it just was not, you know.
At least in concert with the United States. See, this is where the cynics, indeed, the cynics in the audience who know the turn of the CPUSA and the popular front period of the 1930s. Doing opportunistic pragmatism and calling under Browderism, saying that communism is 20th century Americanism, and Bill of Rights communism, Bill of Rights socialism, as a sort of ham-fisted attempt to try to put these pieces back together that had been broken in the 1920s. So what do you take of Browderism? Is it because it's ham-fisted? Is it because it was a Moscow directive? Like, why is it that falls on its face again in the 1930s?
Yeah, actually, so I gave a lecture on this exact question a few years back. I think it was 2020, actually, for Platypus. We did this series of lectures on Marxism and American history, the history of the American Revolution. So I think that's on YouTube if, you know, anyone wants to hear like a fuller engagement on this question.
I'll find the link for that and put it in the notes. Go on,
sorry. But to give you like a summary version, just as I was saying, you know, there was this success in translating Marxism into an American idiom in the Socialist Party in the first two decades of the 20th century. It's not like a full-blown success. And there is still ambivalence, and there should be ambivalence. It's not as if this is like a legacy that can be simply taken up straightforwardly, of course. It's more complicated than that. And it should be understood in a more sophisticated way. Nonetheless, that there, you know, the emotional charge that you can kind of get from invoking these things can't be neglected either, you know. So it's not as if you need to simply qualify everything, you know. There's this tendency now, even among Marxists, who will like acknowledge the revolutionary and progressive role of the bourgeoisie historically, to nonetheless still kind of say, but wasn't really revolutionary, you know. It was really, you know, it was revolutionary, but only for them, or right, something the like planters that. Which is not Marx's.
Planters were slave owners, and that the Constitution, right. Going back to that old, I forget what the 1920s, that progressive school of historiography is, where they go through the Constitution and they look at the material interests of all the founders.
Yes, the beards.
The beards.
Yes, and there were others as well, but there was that was an influential interpretation, and there's a broader trend before the beards that influences them, which is the economic interpretation of history more generally. I think Charles Beard's book is the economic interpretation of the Constitution. I think it's something like that, where he basically argues that the Constitution represents like a counter-revolution.
Right,
that's still a very popular
common thing perspective. You'll hear. Yeah.
You know, today, but it doesn't come from Marxism. It comes from progressive historiography. And there's a whole story to be told about that, but to not get sidetracked, that historiography does have a certain pull in the party. And there is as good as a lot of this material is, there is still nonetheless a pretty noticeable strain of vulgarity among the Marxists in the Socialist Party, and not just among the right wing, you know, on the left wing as well. This sort of oversimplified understanding of Marxism. And, you know, there isn't really like a brilliant expositor of Marxism at a theoretical level in the United States in this period. You know, at least not one that's sort of without any, you know, shortcomings or anything. So, you know, this sort of economic interpretation of history, where it's simply about like the cynical manipulation of the lower classes by the upper classes, and there's not like this more complicated dynamic of revolutionary transformation in which, you know, the rising classes legitimately do represent a progressive development for the whole of society, that gets sort of lost. And there's party literature at the time that characterizes American history this way. There are party figures that will sort of, you know, and there is also a pretty prominent patriotic revival amongst mainstream politics in this period as well, a sort of very Baudelaireized patriotism, if you will, kind of a imperialist patriotism. This is like when American imperialism is really becoming a prominent tendency among the ruling classes in the sense of overseas imperialism. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there is this sort of skepticism, cynicism with respect to this history, and that gets passed on to the Communist Party. A lot of the early communists, for that matter, being very new immigrants to the United States, like immigrants from World War One and after, and especially from, Northern Russian Europe. Imperial holdings.
Yeah, Northern Europe, after, Scandinavia, yeah.
Yes, exactly. You know, Finland and Russia and you know, all of these different, Russian imperial holdings, a lot of them come to the United States in this period and basically form, you know, independent party organizations, you know, language organizations that end up being kicked out of the party in the famous expulsion of the left wing in 1919. And they go on to form sort of the main ranks of the early CP. Mm. But there is a directive from Moscow in this period. This is, of course, Lenin still alive in this period, that they need to give up their left wing infantilism of trying to have this sort of underground illegal revolutionary organization that doesn't make contact with the mainstream American working class. So the directive from the Comintern in this period is basically, you need to, as soon as possible, make the party an above ground legal organization that is engaging with the American working class. And again, so to speak, speaking English, not just literally, but also American, figuratively, right? So there's not, you know, there are some, old guard socialists that are involved in the leadership as well, and wobblies and so on. So Foster is one of them. James Cannon, who goes on to become the founder of American Trotskyism, is one. And they are spearheading this effort to basically Americanize the party. And there is a bit of, there is a bit of this sort of you know, what do we do with this American Revolutionary legacy, you know, in this connection? But the Cannon Foster group, which is like the leading faction in the party, up until the fifth Congress of the Comintern, you know, so after Lenin's death, when the Troika, the Zinoviev, Kamenev, Stalin Troika is, you know, in power, there basically is a radical shift. And this coincides also with the shift in the trade union education elite I mentioned, of Bolshevization of the party, which is, you know, ultimately what it amounts to is making the party organizations on a national level into instruments of the Comintern leadership, as opposed to relatively autonomous. And part of that is a leadership shakeup. So you end up getting, this kind of, there's sort of this, as the party is trying to come out into the open, there is this big conflict going on among the leaders of the party. And ultimately, by the end of the 20s, you have the Bukharinites in power. So then you have, you know, Stalin consolidates power with Bukharin against Zinoviev and Kamenev in the Soviet Union and the Comintern. And so you have like Jay Lovestone and his group are leading the Communist Party towards the end of the 20s. And they, in 1926, take up this American Revolutionary legacy. This is before the Popular Front, which is the next decade. They take up this American Revolutionary legacy in an attempt to do what the Cannon and Foster group was trying to do, which was Americanize the party. So there's, and part of the reason they do this is the 150th anniversary of the American, of the Declaration of Independence of 1776. So there's a lot of this going on at the time. There's a lot of talk of the American Revolution and so on. And so they try to make an appeal to the American working class on that basis, which, you know, I don't think it gets a whole lot of traction, but it doesn't really end up mattering because within a few years, the Lovestone faction is out, and there's another shakeup coming from Moscow that changes up the leadership again. And so ultimately that's where Browder comes in, but Browder is only kind of takes the leadership role later in the early 30s. So with respect to the Popular Front, then there is a revival of, again, the same thing in the mid-30s. But in the mid-30s, the context in which that happens isn't this attempt to Americanize the party. It takes place in a very different context. Namely, the Soviet Union is trying to get a military alliance with the West against Nazi Germany. It's trying to broker an alliance because it's obvious that a war is imminent. And so there is this policy.
A need to have social peace within the United States.
Social peace, exactly. Right. Social peace, and for that matter, there needs to be conciliation with the Democratic Party who's in power. So they go within the course of like a few, you know, within the course of days from condemning the New Deal and Roosevelt as fascist to saying that Roosevelt is the only hope of protecting the United States from the fascism represented by the Republican Party. And so you can only imagine the kind of disorientation that that involves. Yeah. And it's in that context that you get the Popular Front rhetoric of American, you know, communism is the Americanism of the 20th century and so on. So it's a very sort of cynical, disingenuous, empty rhetoric, and very transparently so. And to the people that it wasn't transparently so empty, they were being duped, you know, they were dumb, you know, not to be rude, but you know, they just didn't really understand what was going on, you know?
So already, so this image we have of Browderism is already a vulgarized, ham-fisted portrayal of a process that was happening somewhat organically within the American Marxist movement. So our cynicism towards that Browderism is not wrong, but the cynicism really should arise from the various back and forth swings within the Comintern and the use of this rhetoric and action to strengthen the Popular Front.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's a complicated history. And unfortunately, if you just kind of reduce it to is what Browder did good or not, it sort of misses the whole point, which was Browder was just really being used.
Right.
And then he was thrown away when they were done with him. And, you know, I almost feel bad for him. But, you know, he really was being manipulated. and he was being used to manipulate the party as a whole. And that's the context in which you get this Americanism. So obviously it has a very, you know, it's tainted. Now going back to like the Lovestoneites, they were like the conservative.
Reed, yeah. Hey, let me stop you for a second. We are in the midst of a great conversation. Good history, good theory. We're getting to about the hour mark. So what I'm going to propose is that we go behind the paywall at this point in time. If people out there are not subscribers to the show and you want to hear the rest of this great convo, patreon.com/theantifada. Andy, is this a room for more announcements? Did you want to say something?
Well, I'm not sure we're going to run this, so I guess not.
Yeah, me neither.
By the way, I do have some questions. I've been interested, so I'm just like holding back, but maybe after the paywall.
I should have warned you guys. I am a real rambler, and I don't
it's really good stuff. Right. We'll do more of it on the backside. I have some questions. Andy has some questions. And for people who are subscribers, we're going to talk about my article, The Left Undead, which came out a few weeks ago, that Reed and Andy and I are going to discuss as well. So, folks, we'll see you on the other side. Thanks for listening.
Leaving out the important section has been my secret weapon. Now it's a boot knife. Ruby, I ride the loop tight. Quest for the right note. This is the poetry my life wrote. You niggas thinking the wrong sentences. Chiffon trenches, playing the Monmouth Temple dentist. Locked the doors and barred the exits. There's danger looming in the double halls. Forward slash, forward march. Dark web remind me of a Florida marsh. Post midnight, black glow and blue light. My bulletproof kufi fit right. You see my drip. Cylons ain't wanna see me from the hill. Ain't use my TV in the grip. Negro, I'm on the World Wide Web. Slandering Eugene V. Debs, and I'm having fun with it. My mindset is on an abundance. Motherfuckers is Wakanda pundits. That shit sound dumb to me. Rap Ferreira spit the plus degree. Eee.